We're all aware that our government has initiated an attack on another nation, right? Most of you are aware of this, yes? That is why your gas prices are so high, but I like to read the news and stay informed of the things that are going on in our world, especially in that area of the world, because many of you were here the last time Hannah was with us. Do you guys remember Hannah? She's living in the Middle East, and some of you are getting her updates, and you're seeing the things that are happening there and how that's affecting their life, but it just organizes my thoughts, because, you know, we have it good here, do we not? We have it really good, and what we choose to do with that good is kind of interesting, but Hannah's over there living out the gospel in the Middle East, and one of the headlines I read earlier this week was that Iran had threatened to cut the undersea cables that make the internet work. Everybody go, oh! Right? And in my mind, I thought, wow, that's kind of crazy, and I moved on to the next article. Well, later that night, I was laying in bed, and I was watching some video on the internet, and it just stopped. That dreaded buffer wheel came up, right? And it was just circling, and the guy I was watching, he just, you know, and froze in a really funny position, which is always kind of great. It's like if people on YouTube were to stop it right now, and my face would be like, you know. But I thought, oh, the internet is down for maintenance probably, right? And I'll just connect through my phone hotspot and finish the video I was watching and go to sleep. So I connected to my phone hotspot and nothing. The buffer wheel still was there. And I was like, oh, that's a little weird. Usually if I don't have like my home internet, I can connect through my cell phone internet, right? So I was like, well, maybe I should try to send a text message, make sure, you know, something's going on. So I'll send a text message to myself because, you know, Christine's asleep and y'all are sleeping and everything. I try to send a text message. You know what comes up? That little red exclamation point that says not delivered right next to it. And you know what my next thought was? Iran did it. They cut off the internet. And I'm like, no, that's auto pay. And so I'm laying in bed and I'm starting to wonder what the next day could look like, right? Because we depend on the internet for a lot. And there are people that I think would have a mental breakdown if the internet disappeared, right? Like they're on their phone so much they wouldn't know what to do with their time. Their trusters are fallen jaded. So you start thinking about that, and I depend on the internet for parts of my job, right? I depend on text messaging to get in communication with people, and when you start to think about how far that can stretch, like there was a hockey game the next day that I was looking forward to because the Red Wings were, keyword were, in a playoff race, and they lost last night, and that ended, so I'm real happy today. But I wanted to watch the game because we're in a tight race, right? And I thought, oh, man, I'm not going to be able to stream my hockey game, which is the total first world problem that I think about. But I won't be able to check my bank balance because I don't keep a check register, right? I just log in on my phone. I won't be able to pay the internet bill because that's all through the internet, right? So all of these things that have made life so convenient, things that we've come to expect that are not within our control anymore, could, with one extreme action, unsettle a good portion of life. If you're not an internet snob like us millennials and younger, what would happen to you if the electricity went out? It's funny because I'm pretty sure the folks that are talking and saying these answers would be the grumpiest of us all, wouldn't you think? Can't take a shower, can't do this, you know, and that's the thing. Like we can sit in here in our wonderfully lit streaming YouTube, we can do all this stuff. We expect these things to be stable, don't we? And in an instant, it can change. And you have no power over it at all. You have no power over it at all. It would take a complete relearning of how to do life, don't you think? Things like the internet have become foundational pieces to our lives. Things like electricity. Your car is a foundational piece to your life. Your home, even the relationships that we have, have become foundational. This week we learned that a former elder of this church, now all three of them are here today, so not these guys, right? But a former elder of Rising Church passed away suddenly from a brain aneurysm. He was working and alive when he went to work that morning, and his family never saw him again. Life seems stable, folks, until one day it's not, right? Until one day it's not. It's like having an injury. It's like arthritis. All of a sudden it's here, and you get to deal with it for the rest of your life, right? Hip replacement. It works for a little while. You know? But that's what I want us to see. Because over the next 6 weeks, we're gonna walk through the book of Micah, because I got to be honest, I don't know why I picked Micah for this time after Easter. I think I'm beginning to see it, given Easter and some of the things that I've been studying. I just felt I wanted to do a minor prophet. I wanted to walk us through a minor prophet, because those are the ones that don't get touched because they're weird, right? And preachers don't preach on them. So in part, it's an exercise for me to become a better preacher through this, but in part, it's an exercise for us to be introduced to scripture that we don't hear very often. And this book is honest. This book is incredibly honest. It's going to name what's broken in the world. And it's going to feel uncomfortable at times, but it doesn't leave us there. What it does, what Micah does, is it doesn't stop with what's broken, because Micah, who's a prophet of God, moves us from what's wrong to what God's going to do about it. And so I just want to read the very first book verse in this book and get us introduced. In verse 1, it says, "The word of the Lord." Everybody say, "The word of the Lord." Store that in your memory real quick. We're going to talk about that. "That came to Micah the Moreshite, what he saw regarding Samaria and Jerusalem in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah." This is about all we know regarding Micah. There isn't much detail. There isn't a lot of extra biblical record of him. We know where he's from and that he served as a prophet of God from about 650 BC to 687 BC. But more importantly, I want you to notice these first words. "The word of the Lord came to Micah." And then after the dash that's in there, what do we see? It says what he saw regarding Samaria and Jerusalem. So when we think a word of the Lord, we think of words, right? We think of hearing things. We think of God like vocally speaking. But what we see in that second part is that God gave Micah an image, a vision. He was able to see something that everybody else couldn't see. He could peer into, maybe today a good word for that is, because we talk, our movies are talking a lot about this, is other dimensions, right? He was able to peer into something else, what a future looked like. And Micah received this vision from God. This is not something that Micah is thinking up. It's not something he's predicting. It's not something that he is just writing down on a page as a warning story, as a nursery rhyme, so to speak, to teach a good lesson. Micah's getting this from God. And so when we read what Micah has to say, we're reading what God has to say. That's important. This is God speaking for the people of that day and for us. And so the very next verse, like, we get this one sentence or one sentence thing. And then it jumps into what Micah heard and saw. In verses 2 through 4, it says, "Listen, all you peoples, pay attention, earth and everyone in it. The Lord God will be a great witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. Look, The Lord is leaving his place and coming down to trample the heights of the earth. The mountains will melt beneath him, and the valleys will split apart like wax near a fire, like water cascading down a mountainside. Can you picture that? Mountains are going to melt. On the one hand, that's spooky, isn't it? On the other hand, that's stinking awesome. Like, that's better than any superhero movie has ever depicted, as far as I'm concerned. That is the power of our great God. So this is a stunning vision. He says the mountains are going to melt, the valleys are going to be splitting apart. And one thing that might be helpful is to envision ourselves, like, envision this ourselves, because we live in Flatland, Michigan. Like, we have a hill. And I think down south, they would look at that and go, you call that a hill? You know, so we can see for miles if you cleared all the trees. So to see a staple of a landscape, such as a mountain in our backyard, is difficult. So it might be better to envision something that's maybe been more of a staple in your life, something that doesn't change much. So for instance, for me, out my back windows, my backyard is full of trees. And I love right now, this time of year is super exciting because every morning I get up and I look out and I'm like, are there buds yet? Because I want winter gone, right? I'm looking for the buds. I'm looking for all those things. And those trees don't change very much, right? Like, it's been 5 years. Christine and I, when we got married, we planted a tree in our backyard. And that tree, it's taller. I can tell it's taller, but I wouldn't be able to tell you how much taller it is. It's not a full tree by any means. It's still very young, and I know it's growing, but it's still kind of, you know, I could break it with my hand if I wanted to. But all these other mature trees, they don't change. They all curve the same way. They have squirrel nests in the top that I can see right now. You know, I can see the birds, and we can see the deer through the trees because the undergrowth hasn't filled in just yet. But if one day a tornado came through in the night and took down all my trees in my backyard, it would be an unnerving sight because most of those trees have been there my entire life. Or maybe more real, more soul-hitting is the experience of losing a parent, either through a disruption in a relationship and that relationship is no longer good, or something like dementia where the person is still there but you're struggling to know this person because you've got a lifetime of memories, or inevitably death. Someone that has been there since you started life. This staple has now been removed from your life, and that can be unsettling. That can make your foundation shift a little bit. That's the kind of image that God is invoking here. Things that we have come to feel as always stable, that are foundational in our lives, that support your comfort, that, such as familiarity or beauty, all the way to things that support your life, like treasured relationships. These things aren't eternal, and they can certainly disappear and be destroyed. But we prefer to stay away from that imagery because it invokes a sense of grief in us, doesn't it? But that's exactly why God is bringing this imagery to mind. I want to back up into verses 2 and 3. God commands attention here, which is something that I think we're all more guilty of than we'd like to admit. Do you lose focus on God pretty often? You can be honest, it's a safe place. As I do. Driving, in the shop, in the store shopping. Sometimes even in church right now, you're thinking, oh, I'm hungry, right? We struggle to pay attention to the things that are right in front of us, let alone keeping our eyes on God in the midst of our age of distractions. But he wants the people to know that he's getting up from his throne and coming to earth to cause the mountains to melt, to cause the valleys to split open, to shake the foundations of people's lives because they chose ultimately not to pay attention to God. This is not a close parallel, but it is a parallel of maybe you heard when you were young, just wait till your father gets home. Or go to the principal's office. And that some of you didn't care, but some of you were like, I don't want to face them. Like, I don't have any problem disrespecting you, but I don't want to face them, right? God's getting off his throne and coming to earth. That should make everybody weak in the knees, right? Feeling a little bit of trembling going on. And then what God says is, he says he's going to be a witness against the people. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? That's not a verse that we're going to quote very often. That's not a verse that's going to go on the wall somewhere, right? You don't necessarily want to remember that. God is saying, I am going to be a witness not for, but against the people. Why? Micah 1:5, he says, all of this will happen because of Jacob's rebellion and the sins of the house of Israel. What is the rebellion of Jacob? Isn't it Samaria? And what is the high place of Judah? Isn't it Jerusalem? God begins to fill out the picture that he's giving to us. Jacob is not an individual, well, he was an individual person, but Jacob, his name was changed to Israel. Jacob, when his name is invoked in the Old Testament, oftentimes it represents the collection of God's people, the nation of Israel. And so it's not just one guy that rebelled, it's the nation of God that has rebelled against God. So God doesn't come out of nowhere, is what he's trying to say. God doesn't just act. He doesn't throw lightning bolts. He doesn't come out of heaven just because he felt like it one day. He wanted to check out things going on. Something has been wrong for a long time. And this is what it is. God is no longer going to stay silent. And when God comes down in Micah, everything melts, which should honestly make us ask, what happens if God comes near to us? Now, we got to fill in some background information here, so hang with me for a second, but quick history. In this time period, the nation of Israel is divided into two different kingdoms. There's a northern kingdom that is still called Israel, and its capital is Samaria. And then there's a southern kingdom called Judah, whose capital is Jerusalem. The capitals of a nation represent the nation, right? That's who God is calling out, Jerusalem and Samaria. If the capital is conquered, generally the nation is too, right? If foreign forces came in and occupied Washington, D.C., obviously there would be major battles and different things like that would go on, but ultimately the nation of the United States would be in big, big trouble, right? What happens in the capital affects the rest of the nation. In Samaria, there was lots of idol worship. They didn't worship God alone. It was God plus other gods. And it had infected both Israel and Judah and all of God's people. Jerusalem didn't try to stop it. In a lot of ways, they embraced this idol worship. The city is set on a mountain and at this point had existed for generations. It's still sacred, but it's been corrupted. And God accuses them of rebellion and sin. Rebellion and sin are different. Rebellion meaning a willful or criminal breaking of God's covenant. And sin has a literal meaning of just missing the target. So I don't know if you've ever tried to shoot a bow and arrow. It's a really good image for this. You might aim for the center of that target, and then the arrow doesn't even hit the target at all. You ever had that humbling experience before? Yeah. I look at that kind of like everyday life, in sin in everyday life, right? Because we're all corrupted in some way. We want to love the things that God loves, and we're trying to aim for the center of that, but we don't quite make it, right? We miss the target. Still needs to be corrected, but it's not that big of a deal. When we talk about rebellion, though, that's taking the arrow and not aiming for the target, but for the instructor that's right next to you. Does that make a difference? Make sense to you? That's what rebellion is. It's not even like you're trying to hit the target. You're just doing whatever you want to do. You're in charge. And so when he says rebellion and sin, he's amplifying this idea. The scary idea then of God coming down isn't because of a drifting away from God or an ignorance of sin. This has been a deliberate choosing to move away from God's laws and decisions to worship other gods in order to cash in on any benefit that each might have to offer. If you have a CSB study Bible, one of the notes that's in the commentary at the bottom says this: Samaria's idolatry and immorality were so deep that God marked her for destruction. Do you worry that that might be our world today? When you begin to uncover the background of some of this stuff, you begin to be able to diagnose what might be happening in our country, in our city, in our churches. God is getting off of his throne because of Jacob's rebellion. Because people aren't even trying to hit the target anymore. And we see this in the next couple of verses. In Micah 1, 6 through 7, it says, "Therefore I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the countryside, a planting area for a vineyard. I will roll her stones into the valley and expose her foundations. All her carved images will be smashed to pieces." Carved images means idols. "All her wages will be burned in the fire, and I will destroy all her idols. Since she collected the wages of a prostitute, they will be used again for a prostitute." Church, God is no liar. This was said relatively early on in time, and in 7, the dates are debated exactly about when it happened. There are different timelines as far as how people categorize what happened and what baseline they use. But we'll just say in about 722 BC, the vision to Micah from God was fulfilled. Assyria attacked and leveled the city of Samaria. God's people that lived there were forced to relocate. They were sent into exile. And that is to say that what God plans to do, God is going to do. There is no controlling it. There is no stopping it. There is no changing his mind. And the things that we build our lives on are more fragile than we think. This isn't random or unjustified. It's the result of deliberately choosing to build a life on something other than God. That's the rebellion here. The sin of all of this isn't just murder or cheating or lust or self-centeredness. It's the fact that what they had given themselves over to, what they had built their lives on, was something other than God himself. It was God plus something else. They trusted God, but when he didn't act or when they figured he was too slow, they trusted in this other thing too. And church, that's never gone away. That's never gone away. For centuries, believers have been fighting against their own skepticism of God, their own impatience with God, their own desire to rule as if they were God. And we are not special. We are not immune to the slow drift building our lives on something other than God alone. We just don't do it the way they did it with golden calves and carved images. They would spend a significant amount of time, money, thought, and energy trying to change the trajectory of their lives by praying to, let's say, the sun god or the rain god so that they would have a harvest to support their family. What do we spend, then, significant amounts of time, money, thoughts, and energy into? You follow that thread and you'll find what you've been building your life on. You'll find what it is that you worship, what idol you worship. 5 years ago, Lifeway Research polled 1,000 pastors in the United States about what modern day idols have significant influence in their churches. 2/3 of those pastors said that their church was affected by the idol of comfort. It was number one on the list. That most of these pastors said that in their churches, their sheep, the people that they lead, maybe even they themselves, maybe they were seeing themselves in this, spend significant amounts of time, money, thoughts, and energy into securing their own comfort. Half of those pastors said that their church was influenced by idols of control, security, money, approval, success, and social influence. And a third of those pastors said that political power and sex were idols present in the churches that they serve. We love to think that the problem is one that's out there. We love to think that the problem is something that's going on in another place, in another church, in another person, in another country, in another state. But I think, and I don't know all of you personally, but I dare say I know that at least one of those things tugs at you. And chances are you've caught yourself in a season of God plus comfort, God plus money, God plus control, God plus approval, God plus sex. When God is silent, or when you feel like God isn't answering, or when God doesn't seem to be enough, you trust in, you stand on that idol. That's your firm foundation, not Jesus. You see what I'm getting at this morning? And through Micah, God is saying that the mountain that you're building your life on, that thing that you trust in, that thing that you've run to when God didn't satisfy, that thing that's providing something for you, it's not going to hold. It's not going to hold. And this certainly weighs on us, as it should. In fact, that's how Micah is feeling after getting this picture from God. So in the next verse, he says, "Because of this, I will lament and wail. I will walk barefoot and naked. I will howl like the jackals and mourn like ostriches." I have never heard an ostrich mourn before. I got to imagine it is not a fun sound to hear. But it just adds to this image that Micah is weeping. He's grieved. He can see the destruction and the devastation that's coming as a result of this idolatry, this rebellion, this sin. That is to say that Micah's feeling it. He's not saying, "Well, y'all get what you deserve." That's not the response. He didn't get all self-righteous and say, "Well, man, God showed me this image and I'm going to go tell you guys that you suck." Because haven't you had someone in your life do that to you before? This challenge that you're facing, this is on you. Sucks to be you. No. Micah may be angry, but where sometimes our anger provokes in us a fix-it response, he seems to recognize that it's not his issue to fix. He's not distancing himself from this. He's not putting up walls. He's not pushing it away. He's allowing himself to feel it. For whatever reason, God chose Micah to reveal this vision to, and he's not backing away from it. He's in it. He's mourning with God in it. And then in verse 9, he says something that is so important. He says, and remember, this is the word of the Lord. This is God speaking. "For her wound is incurable and has reached even Judah. It has approached my people's city gate as far as Jerusalem." He says this is an incurable wound. This is terminal. There is nothing that can be done to fix this. Those are the most depressing words you could ever hear, right? Nothing more can be done. So often, we think that sin is just this discipline thing. We think that rebellion is an attitude. People just, ultimately, they don't care about what's going on in their life. They don't care about the people around them. They don't care, whatever the case may be. We make up all of these things to try and categorize it and distance ourselves from sin. And the question I have to ask you in that is have you ever tried to fix something in your life, but you couldn't? Hey, have you ever tried to stop doing something that you knew was wrong, but it's been a habit your entire life, and you just fail after fail after fail? Have you been there? It isn't because you don't care. It's because something deeper in you is off. The problem isn't really just what we've done. It's what we are. The rest of the chapter, Micah, I'm not going to read it because I'll embarrass myself trying to read all of these cities. But from verses 10 to 16, Micah is listing city after city after city after city, not to confuse us or to be long-winded or to serve as even a record. The purpose is to show us that this rebellion, this sin, while the epicenter might be in one place, Samaria, it spreads everywhere. Church, brokenness doesn't stay contained, and I'm sure that you've experienced that. Like, sin and rebellion, it affects our relationships. When we snap, we isolate, we lie, we manipulate, all in an effort to protect what? Our idols. You ever notice that? I've caught myself. Keep in mind, Christine and I have only been married 5 years. We're still in our honeymoon, right? But I've caught myself. There are times when I have come in from, cutting wood outside or something, and I go to sit down on the couch, and she's in the kitchen making my dinner. And I will, my rear end will hit the couch, and she'll say, "Hey, do you have a minute? Can you come help me?" And I'm like, "No," right? What am I protecting right there? My comfort, my peace. I'm looking forward to relaxation. Any other time, that would not be my answer, right? Hope not. But in that moment, when I've been stressed out, tired, whatever the case may be, in that moment is different. And it's revealing what I want to protect in that moment. Now, does that mean that I should stay up 24/7 and, go to the extremes? No, everybody, you understand that there are limits to the person. But when we snap, it's to protect our idols. When we isolate ourselves, when we remove ourselves from our family, our community, our lives, our work, we're protecting our idols. When we lie to people, we're keeping control. We're protecting our comfort. We're protecting our idols. When we manipulate other people, we're protecting our idols. We are serving not God. We are serving our idols, which is to say that we're being self-serving too. Comfort, money, control, sex, approval, name whatever you want, it spreads first in our homes. If you're married to your spouse, if your parents, to your parents if you live with them, to your kids if you have them, even if they can't name it, they feel what rebellion is in you. What you really worship, because that idol influences the decisions that you make with your time, your money, your thoughts, your energy. And in many cases, they learn to rebel like you, or, man, this kind of made my head spin a little bit, but they rebel against your rebellion. Have you ever noticed that? Well, if you're going to get angry with me, I'm going to get angry with you, right? Or they just completely withdraw from they go into the isolation to protect their own comfort, their own sanity. Hurt people, right? We've heard that before. And so this idea is that rebellion and sin, it breeds, it spreads like a virus. It moves around, it replicates, and it goes out. And so our communities are then made up of what? Households. right? Go outside and look. All made up of households. This church, if you were to break this church down into smaller pieces, what would it look like? Households, right? We all gather together. We come into this place to worship. And so, if your house is infected and you participate in a church or in a community or in another organization, and you bring that sin and rebellion with you into that place, you're going to keep spreading that, just like if the chicken pox broke out, right? Now you're like, well, we already had the chicken pox. Well, shingles. How about that? All right? Does that make sense? This stuff spreads because we learn to throw up walls. We learn to fight back. We learn that you're not looking out for me. You're looking out for you. You're serving your idols, so I'm going to serve my idols. And it becomes this tit for tat, dog eat dog. And if you look around in our world, we all say that the politicians are corrupt, right? What are they serving? Their own idols, which makes you serve what? Your own idols, right? God says, give to Caesar what's to Caesar. You're like, no way, right? Yeah. We look at the laws that we make and we make our own judgments of whether or not which ones we're going to follow. And I'm not saying there's not any wisdom to some of that. I'm just saying the fact is that sin begets sin. Rebellion begets rebellion. And so the rebellion in one household can spread to another through the griping, through the stories, through God dishonoring advice, through a myriad of ways, until our communities, whether that be a small church community like ours, the community that we live in, or as big as the national stage, are overwhelmed in rebellion. What starts in one place never stays there, but church. God is not silent. God is not silent. What we trust, in is not going to hold. And what's broken in us runs deeper than what we thought or what we want to admit. And through Micah, God says that the wound is incurable. So what do you do when the problem isn't just what you've done, but what you are? Here's the conundrum for me as, you know, preaching this. There ain't any hope in chapter 1. We got to wait till chapter 2 to get there. But let me try to offer you a little bit of hope, because we just came off of Easter, and the last thing I want to do is drop a nuclear bomb and be like, well, that was stupid, right? Micah doesn't answer here, but this isn't the end of what God has revealed to him. Because if God is the one who says that the wound is incurable, then he's also the only one that can do something about it. And Scripture tells us that God does, in fact, come near again. Not to bring judgment on his people, but to take it onto himself. Which means the things that we cannot tear down in our lives, the idols that we keep running back to, the brokenness that we cannot fix, God does not ignore it, and he most definitely isn't going to stay silent about it. These things, they feel like mountains. And when God comes near, those mountains will melt. What feels like a mountain of idolatry in your life, the thing that you keep running to, and you've been thinking about it ever since I mentioned it, you know it's a problem in your life. When God comes near, he's going to cause that idol to melt. He's going to smash the carved images. He's going to take that away. That's what God has promised. We saw his promise fulfilled. In 722, when he made the prophecy about that, and when he says he's going to do that in us, he's going to do that in us too. God has started a work in us, and he will see it through until completion. We know that these things are terrible things to build our lives on, and God has promised to replace the foundations. And the longing that we have to fix what's broken, the wound that just won't heal up, we know that our God is the great physician. Psalm 147:3 says he heals the brokenhearted and bandages their wounds. God has already stepped in to heal what it is that we cannot fix. So the invitation before us here today is twofold. The first thing that I think we can do is we can take a minute to look at the things that we spend our time, our money, our thoughts, our energy on. That's going to reveal to you what you actually worship. It's an exercise. It's an opportunity. Some of you work 50, 60, 70 hours a week. And I want to say, that doesn't mean that you worship your work or money or success. It doesn't mean that. But it could. Are you seeing what I'm saying? It could. Because, for example, if you work to avoid your family, then it's become an escape. You trust in work to give you something that only God can supply in this season. And this is a really incredibly important reflection, because it reveals your life is built on God plus something. In church, we all have that something that we're drawn to. So I would encourage you to look at that. Look at the data. Data doesn't lie. It just reveals. And I think the second part of this invitation is this. Come off what you've been standing on. We know the place that we keep running to when life feels unstable. We know what it is to. We know what it is that we reach for when God feels slow or silent or not enough. Notice it, but take action on that. Step down off of that foundation. Step down off of that thing that you're trusting to be stable, but you know it's not. It's kind of like walking on thin ice, right? The invitation today is to stop asking comfort to save you. To stop asking money to secure you. To stop asking approval to define you. To stop asking control to protect you. And instead, bring that false foundation before God and say, Lord, this is what I've been standing on, and I know it won't hold. Teach me to stand on you. That is our hope. A God who is not silent, a God who shows us that the foundations that we're standing on, he draws near to show us that the things that we've built our lives on won't hold. And then he stretches his arms open wide and says, I'm available. I'm here. And I am a strong foundation. Come off of what you've been building on and build your life on me.